We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Persh and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. And just as last week, we have so much to cover. We'll just pound right through it. Starting with the proposed Metro cuts.
Metro has announced a series of new savings in their budget that will enable them to cut a little bit of the cuts. Now, these are not the cuts to bus routes and timing and whatnot that are coming up in the next few weeks. There's a there's another wave of them that's now scheduled for early next year that was supposed to cut an additional 550,000 annual service hours in King County. The announcement this week will scale those cuts back to 400,000 annual service hours, or about 11% fewer. And they'll do it largely by some accounting tricks. They're going to be delaying a third round of cuts and consolidating them into one round of cuts rather than the third and fourth wave. Now, there's no new revenues attached to any of this because, of course, that would require a public
raising
funding
taxes.
Funding of public agencies can't have that. But they are going to save some money, about $10 million a year in recurring savings, largely through non-wage labor cuts, that is to say health care and workers' compensation, automation, lower projected diesel prices, etc. But the big sum is basically an accounting trick. It's a $90 million one-time savings by changing their schedules to require fewer purchases of new buses. That'll be $40 million of it, and discounts on the remaining purchases, which is another $50 million.
Yeah. And see, where that concerns me is that's a hit to their capital. That's a hit in their capital budget. And when you delay purchase of new buses, you start to have more breakdowns and other problems.
And safety issues.
Yeah, and safety issues. And I'm not happy with that.
Yeah. The idea then would be to deferring the scheduled cuts to 2016. So they're not eliminating those cuts entirely. They're just delaying them by a year. And the idea behind that, hopefully, is be able to get more revenue through additional sales tax if the economy recovers, not because the tax rates will be higher, but because hopefully there'd be more sales tax just through the economy. They're scheduled to negotiate a new labor contract, so they're going to try and get more concessions from the drivers again. The U-Link will be opening on the light rail branch going up to Northgate, and hopefully there will be some additional revenue and some economies of scale there. And then the chances, and this is the most amusing part of it, chances for political solutions or potentially additional funding from Olympia. Maybe they'll even pass a transportation budget. Now there's a concept. So somewhat good news in that the cuts won't be quite as severe as they had been scheduled to be, but they're still going to be pretty bad. Yeah. And there's still no real long-term solution to keep this from continuing to happen.
All right. Moving on, some Census Bureau stats out this week.
Yeah, the Census Bureau released some stats on Thursday about rent in the 50 major cities around the United States. Seattle is now among the top 10 cities with the highest median rent. And this is the first time ever, at $1,172 per month. Now, the median rent is the rent you would pay if you were exactly in the middle of renters in Seattle. 50% would pay a higher rent than you do, and 50% would pay a lower rent than you do.
It can't possibly be accurate.
I know you've been looking at rent that's much higher than that, haven't you?
Yes, yeah. I have. And in fact, just about if you go on Craigslist, almost everything listed is higher than that.
Yeah, and Seattle. These are stats that are about a year or two old because they're looking at from 2010 to 2013. So it's now about a year and a half past these statistics. Seattle is number 10 on the list. Now, the other cities on the list fall into two categories. One of those categories are much larger cities on the East Coast, like Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York. The second category are cities that have a great climate and where a lot of wealthy people live, like San Jose, California, San Francisco, San Diego, Honolulu, Hawaii, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Los Angeles. Seattle is the weird outlier there. It's a much smaller city than most of the others on the list, and it's got a much broader mix of income levels
Not anymore.
Of course, yeah, that's changing rapidly. Of course, by dint of our geography, we have limited land space and poor planning. There's a big pushback among neighborhood activists to increase density, plus almost no work on the city council level or at the mayor's level in terms of trying to help fund or regulate affordable housing so that developers are required to build it rather than simply providing an incentive, which has not produced much affordable housing in the past couple of decades.
And unlike other cities in the Northwest, also there's no impact fee, so there's no money for infrastructure to accommodate all these new units.
Yeah, and you know, between 2010 and 2013, which is the period of time they were looking at, median rent in Seattle shot up by $113, or nearly 11%, which is the biggest rise in all of the nation's 50th largest cities. Most other big cities saw an increase that averaged about 3 to 5%, so ours is more than double that. The majority of apartments in Seattle now rent for over $1,000, and most well over $1,000. About 60% of them do. The ones that are under $1,000, well, you probably need to qualify for some kind of housing or federal assistance in order to even apply for those.
Yeah, at this point, there's very few free market housing out there that for less than $1,000 a month. And if you have a family, if you need, say, a two bedroom, you're very lucky to find something for under $1,500 or $1,600.
Yeah, and you know, the biggest need for housing is among people with families who you know, the parents make minimum wage and they can't afford a two bedroom or a three bedroom apartment. That's where the biggest shortage is.
And Jav, weren't you saying that apartments
are not a solution?
Are going to solve it either?
Oh yeah, you go online. And I was looking at this because, well, I don't need that much space, so certainly I can afford that. And you know, the company that controls most of the apartments in Seattle, you have to demonstrate from a paycheck. You can't be, say, self-employed or freelance or anything like that. Four times the proposed rent in annual income from pay stubs, which is a standard that very few people can meet, actually. You know, the old idea used to be that the ideal is to have 30% of your income going toward rent, so it'd be even lower than that.
Of your income before taxes.
Yeah, income before taxes. And that's just not true anymore. For most people in Seattle, it's more like half or more.
And you know, and when these developers or these housing companies require you to, you know, have four times the amount of rent as income, what they're really saying is well, we're catering to the high tech crowd. We want to get people into our aid podments who are going to eat out a lot, who are going to spend their money in the community, and it really just pushes a lot of poor people out of the city. So those aid podments are not really a viable solution for low income housing.
Yeah, even though they've been sold that way,
and
the
they've
city
been
council level.
Marketed for, you know, young people just starting out or people who don't have a lot of money.
Yeah, marketed to the city council. All right, let's move on. A report out by USPIRG this week on highway boondoggles.
Yes, U.S. Public Interest Research Group released a report. The title is Highway Boondoggles, Wasted Money and America's Transportation Future. And they looked at least 11 highway projects that illustrate the wrong priorities of federal and state governments towards transportation planning. Number one on that list, I bet you can guess, it's the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct here in Seattle. That was number one on their list of national highway boondoggles. State and federal government, the whole point of the report is that the state and federal government are focusing on big highway projects at a time when Americans are really driving a lot less. Per capita driving has fallen 7% in the last 9 years. That means that decrease started well before the recession and that it hasn't, quote unquote, recovered like other sectors of the economy. Now, in large part, that's a demographic shift. The baby boomers owned more cars and drive many, many more miles every day than millennials do. A lot of millennials don't even get a driver's license these days. A lot of them rely on bicycles, their feet, and public transit. Just at a time when state and federal governments are cutting funds in a lot of cases, particularly here in the state of Washington, for transit. And the demographic shift is going in exactly the opposite direction.
Although, you know, to be fair, the Alaska Way Viaduct Project is not actually a highway project. It's a real estate project that uses the highway as an excuse,
for developing the waterfront. Yeah.
Which is pretty much true for all of the quote-unquote transportation projects in Seattle.
Yeah, and many of the projects on the list are toll roads, which means that with less driving going on, those toll roads are going to saddle the taxpayers in those communities with high debt that can't be paid off in the way that the folks who structured the deal initially envisioned. So that's an issue, too.
And we're running into that with the tunnel as well, where they can't even come up with a pricing model for the toll for the tunnel that makes any sense.
Yeah, it just means a lot of people are not going to use it.
All right. Also out this week, a report on state tax growth. From our friends at S&P?
Yeah, significant decline in annual state tax growth among the 10 states who are most reliant on sales tax revenue. And, of course, Washington is one of the most, by far the most regressive tax structure in the country. And that's largely a function of the fact that Washington is so heavily reliant on sales tax and has no personal or corporate income tax. What the Standards and Poor's study is basically saying is that that's not just an average an issue of fairness and equity among who gets hit with a high tax bill, but it's also a serious impediment to tax growth and to growth of the local economy. That might be an argument that resonates in certain political circles where the fairness argument does not. But the other thing that they found that was linked to that was a very high correlation between that and income inequality, where you get a small number of very, very wealthy people and then a much larger number of people who are struggling. And that certainly is something we're seeing in the Puget Sound region as well.
All right. Also, moving on to national tail end of last week was a report on the Navy apparently looking into people's computers here in Washington State.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court threw out a case. A three-judge panel threw out the case against an Algona, Washington man convicted of distributing child pornography. They set him free even though he had been convicted. And he was set to serve an 18-year sentence, not because he was innocent. He was still guilty of distributing child pornography. But they set him free because of how the evidence against him was obtained. The NCIS, the Naval Criminal Intelligence Service, the court ruled, had violated the Posse Comitatus Act by spying on civilians in the state of Washington. Here's a direct quote from the court ruling. Quote, it has become a routine practice for the Navy to conduct surveillance of all the civilian computers in an entire state to see whether any child pornography can be found on them and then turn over that information to civilian law enforcement when no military connection exists.
Now, why does the Navy care about that?
Yeah. Now, aside from the fact that the Navy is looking at every single computer owned by every single person in an entire state, which is itself a violation of privacy rights under the Constitution, the question is, why is the Navy engaging in an activity that is really falls under the purview of the FBI? And why is the Department of Justice going to court to defend the NCIS? Now, the judges heavily scolded the Department of Justice, saying that they had seen and scolded the Department of Justice about this problem before, which means this is not the first case in which has come up before the court about this issue.
And this is just in one district court.
But the DOJ continues to try to defend these practices, probably because the federal government itself, many different agencies. Intelligence agencies and the federal government itself are engaging in these kinds of mass surveillance. Now, the Washington State was targeted for this kind of thing by the NCIS because we're a coastal state, for one thing. The Navy operates mostly in coastal states, and we happen to have a lot of military bases here, so the probability that the guy might have been a military person was higher than it would be in, say, a state that doesn't have as many military bases. But that's a bogus argument, according to the court, and of course, I agree with them.
All right. Also out this week, a study of contaminated drinking water.
Yeah, a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences about contaminated drinking water in Texas and Pennsylvania. Natural gas wells, it turns out, are causing pollution in drinking water sources in those two states. They did not say that it was linked to fracking. However, they said the problems with well casings were the main cause. And of course, the well casings are in wells that are subject to fracking. Now, previous studies have shown that some well casings are being improperly installed and others have cement that was improperly mixed, which would point to problems with subcontractors doing a quick and dirty job making those well casings. Now, also the longer length of natural gas shafts, the fact that they're horizontally or diagonally drilled, and the increased seismic activity in areas where fracking occurs probably also contribute heavily to natural gas and methane leaks into groundwater and drinking water sources.
And you saw a bunch of media coverage of that study saying that, the problem is wells, so that fracking has been exonerated because the study didn't find the fracking causes. It was the wells that caused it. Just sort of like saying, you know, gun violence isn't responsible for the deaths. It's the bullets.
It's the crazy person. It isn't the gun that gave them the means to kill, 20 or 30 people. That's the problem.
All right. Moving on. The tasty new corn and soybean coming to a store near you.
Yeah, the Department of Agriculture this week approved genetically engineered seeds for corn and soybeans resistant to the pesticide 2,4-D. I should point out that 2,4-D is part of the mix that's in Agent Orange, although 2,4-D is not the one usually implicated in most of the terrible health effects of Agent Orange. Dow Chemical wants to sell these seeds along with a pesticide mix called Enlist Duo, which is a mix of 2,4-D plus glyphosate, better known as Roundup. So, of course, people will, if you eat that corn and soybeans, you'll get a double exposure, not just to Roundup, but also now to 2,4-D. Now, this pesticide mix came about because about 70 million acres of U.S. cropland is now infested with weeds that are resistant to Roundup or glyphosate. And that's because of the Roundup Ready seeds that have been used widely on that cropland. Monsanto is trying to get its own chemical combo approved. It wants to get a seed approved that is resistant to both glyphosate and dicamba so that it can pump out its own chemical mixture there. So just as environmentalists had warned, Roundup Ready seeds were not a way to lower the pesticide levels in food. It's really just another way to start making these new compounds that will double, triple, quadruple the amount of pesticide you're going to see on your food. Everyone should switch to organic.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with a congressional vote to fund another war.
Yeah, the House and Senate both approved funding for the air war in Iraq against ISIS and, of course, arming militias to fight ISIS on the ground. It's part of the stopgap funding bill that Congress voted on to keep the government running till December 11th when a new budget can hopefully be passed.
And then they turned around and promptly adjourned for the next 2 months.
Yeah, for the next...
After having just gotten back from a two-month vacation.
Yeah, and without addressing a lot of crying needs like money for people who are unemployed. So, of course, the money for our air war against ISIS will expire in December 11th unless Congress votes again to expand funding for Obama's new low-intensity war. Meanwhile, military experts this week agreed that it could take 6 to 9 months to train the first 5,000 fighters to take on ISIS. ISIS itself has initial estimates were 10,000 fighters. Now the DOD says it's closer to 25 to 30,000 fighters in Iraq and Syria. So, of course, to arm a decent number of fighters to really take them on is going to take years. according to what military experts have said. Now, the Pentagon also admitted this week that driving ISIS out of the cities of Mosul and Fallujah will be particularly difficult. Urban warfare usually is. The Iraqi government has promised this week that it will stop indiscriminate bombing of Sunni civilians with artillery and its air force. Apparently, dropping barrel bombs is not enough. Pinpoint bombing in order to keep from killing more civilians than you do ISIS militants.
But our bombs are highly targeted. They only kill bad people.
Well,
because we define everybody as bad people, so they only kill bad people.
That's the U.S. myth. So keep that in mind when you hear about we're making progress in targeting ISIS militias with U.S. air bombing in Iraq.
Was that progress what occurred this week with Syria and Robert Perry talking about negotiations there?
Yeah, the Obama administration, according to Perry and sources of his, has been working through the Russian government to secure an agreement from the Assad government in Syria to permit the U.S. airstrikes against ISIS in parts of Syria. Now, that was something of a concern with Obama's original plan because he's talking about bombing ISIS, but technically, at least, Syria still controls that territory, and so it's an act of war against Syria. So part of the mobilization for this is to try and obtain diplomatic permission to go ahead and bomb in Iraq and Syria. Iraq, of course, is no problem because the Iraqi government is so heavily dependent on U.S. military anyway. But Syria, which the United States government has said it wants to drive out the government of Assad, was a different matter. So if those reports are accurate, it very much paves the way for the U.S. To intensify its air campaign there.
Actually, the Obama administration has not said that they want to drive Assad out of power. They would prefer that he set up a power-sharing government there. So you can kind of see what direction we're headed with Syria. Syria is probably going to be an unacknowledged partner in the war against ISIS, I think.
Yeah.
Now, one of the issues that has troubled me is the fact that ISIS gets a lot of its funding. In fact, you could argue most of its funding from shipping oil across the border in tanker trucks into southern Turkey in order to be sold on the black market in Turkey. And the U.S. has known this for a long period of time. They've had the opportunity to target those tanker trucks with fighter jets and to bomb them, but we haven't done that. And I think that's in large part because there are elites in Turkey, rich folks, and possibly people who are also in the Turkish government who make money and military who make money off of black market oil that's being shipped from northern Iraq by ISIS rebels. And so that's something that Obama said that he wanted to do, is to cut off funding to ISIS. Well, we could do that, but we're not really doing that.
One of the complicating dynamics there, and of course everything about the Middle East is complicated in this way, but also the part of Turkey that we're talking about is Turkish Kurdistan. Where there's a heavy Turkish military presence. There's a long history of military abuses there. And in theory, in Iraq and Syria and Iran, we work with the Kurds. But in Turkey, we turn a blind eye to their problems. And this is, again, something where we want to help the people who are oppressing the Kurds in Turkey, even as we try and help their cousins across the border. It's very, very odd all the way around.
All right. Moving on, developments this week regarding Ebola in Africa.
Yeah. As the headlines this morning are saying, the country of Sierra Leone has been put on 3 days of a lockdown where people literally are not being allowed out of their homes as a radical measure to try and help slow down the spread of Ebola. Obama earlier this week finally made a major commitment toward stopping this. He pledged $500 million and a number of military troops, but no healthcare workers for the U.S. to send to West Africa, to these countries. And it's interesting, of course, that the U.S. has military that it can export to these kind of trouble spots, but not necessarily healthcare workers.
Well, some of the military are considered military support people and may include some health care workers.
But it also underscores the fact that and the lockdown in Sierra Leone underscores the fact that people are starting to panic in these countries, and it's starting to get you're really starting to get a loss of civil order there, particularly because a lot of the borders between these countries, they're very small countries. And very poor countries, and the borders are very porous between them. There's a lot of back and forth among a lot of these coastal West African countries. Right now, people are panicking because there's the Ebola is spread has been very widespread in countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone, and there really hasn't been the resources so far to even seriously slow it down.
All right. And a report out this week on forced labor in Malaysia.
Yeah, the group Verite issued a report on forced labor in Malaysia's high-tech industry. Verite was commissioned by the U.S. Labor Department to investigate the working conditions in electronic factories in Malaysia, especially for migrant laborers from countries like Bangladesh, India, Burma, Vietnam, Nepal, and other places. 94% of migrant laborers in those factories had their passports taken away when they arrived in Malaysia, and they don't have access to their passports, don't know if they can get them back in order to leave if they want to leave their job. 92% had paid huge recruitment fees that exceeded more than 1 month's pay. And of those folks, 77% borrowed money at high interest rates in order to pay the recruitment fee. Then have spent more than a year working to try to pay off the fee. In one case, they interviewed a man from Nepal who had spent 14 months trying to pay off his debt, and he'd gotten barely one third of the way through, which means it was going to take him more than 3 years to pay off his recruitment fee. And while they're paying their recruitment fees, of course, they can't save money, which means they can't just leave their job, drop their debt, pay for a plane ticket home, and most of them can't send money back home, which is the reason why they left home in the first place to try to get a decent job. Now, Western companies that contract with factories in Malaysia include Apple, which contracts with about 30 factories in Malaysia, Flextronics, Samsung, and Sony also. Workers often work 7 days a week, and they work overtime to try to pay their debts. In the meantime, as I said, they can't save any money. It's essentially slave labor, really, that's involved in assembling cell phones and phablets and tablets and other products that we like to get for cheap and take for granted here in the West.
All right. And finally, developments with Chile and going back to the coup.
Yeah, of course, 9/11 having passed last week, and the anniversary of 9/11 that doesn't get any attention in this country was the widespread massacre that was helped with the U.S.-backed fascist coup in Chile in 1973, including the murder and assassination of Victor Jara and a number of others in the Santiago Stadium in that year. And over the past year or so, there have been judicial proceedings to try and catch up with the military and retired military folks who were responsible for that assassination. And three retired ex-army officials indicted this past week. Judge Miguel Vasquez Plaza indicted them for their roles in the killing of Victor Jara. A former military prosecutor, a couple of other former military people indicted for kidnapping and murder, and cover up of what actually happened. The new charges are in addition to those brought against eight other ex-military officers over the past year or so. Chilean prosecutors are also accusing a 12th man of being a responsible party in Jara's death, but the extradition request issued by the Chilean Supreme Court to the United States, where that 12th suspect, Pedro Barrientos Nunez, is now living, I'm guessing in Miami or somewhere thereabouts, has not been honored. The United States is not particularly interested in seeing folks associated with that come to justice.
All right. Events.
As Maria alluded earlier in the program, some climate things going on this weekend. Today at 5 o'clock, the climate crisis, Which Way Out, will be a live streamed panel discussion. The discussion itself is happening in New York, but it will be shown in Seattle. with strategy and tactics for the climate justice movement. Opening remarks by Senator Bernie Sanders. Panelists will include Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Seattle's own Shama Sawant, the councilwoman. So it's going to be shown at the Bertha Knight Landis Room in City Hall, on the first floor of City Hall at 5th and James. So go check that out. A lot of very good people talking about that. And of course, that's in advance on Sunday of global demonstrations for People's Climate Change March. That includes in Seattle. So that will be at 1 o'clock at Westlake Park, the People's Climate March. So
On Sunday.
Sunday. So go and check that out.
Also on Sunday, after the People's Climate March, is a community barbecue at the Rainier Beach Urban Farm and Wetlands. That's Seattle's largest urban farm at 5513 South Cloverdale Street. That's just south of Pritchard Island Beach Park and east of Rainier Beach High School. So check that out if you're hungry after the march. And I just want to put in an early plug for a couple of events at Town Hall next weekend. Not this weekend, but next weekend on Sunday, September 28th. Two great speakers at Town Hall in the downstairs space. Helen Caldicott speaking on Fukushima's ongoing impact. And in the upstairs space, Naomi Klein on capitalism versus the climate. So check those out next weekend.
Yeah, and in fact, particularly for Naomi Klein, but also Helen Caldicott is a remarkable speaker. But mm-hmm. Klein, that's almost certainly going to sell out, so get your tickets quickly.
Yeah.
And Monday morning, Seattle City Council, 9:30 a.m., is having a hearing regarding the Seattle Housing Authority rent increases. So 9:30 a.m.
Yeah.
I think Monday the City Council is discussing a support for banning neonicotine pesticides from use in city parks to save the bees. So you might want to check that out too.